You touched my heart.
Hello, this is The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal from 4EB in Brisbane. Today, Catalonians vow to hold a vote for independence on Sunday as the Spanish government moves to shut it down.
The right to freedom of expression, assembly, association, and public participation have been breached in Spain with this act. They are treating the people that would like to vote like a criminal.
An untimely accident leads to calls for tighter gun controls.
The greater majority of firearm crime is being committed by the people who are criminals. Now, criminals don't abide by the law. So making more laws that only target the law-abiding is having no impact on the criminals.
And research shows young people are politically engaged but don't know how the system works.
Government's own figures shows that Year 10 students, about 50% of them, are not at the proficient level. And by the time they leave high school, they are very uncertain about what and how governments function.
All of that and more coming up soon. Thanks for tuning in to The Wire, where we broadcast all around the country on Indigenous and community radio. First, after an unfortunate accident involving a young boy, gun control advocates are calling for tighter regulations of firearms. But not everyone sees this as the solution to the problem of gun violence. Bianca Chrovat has this story.
Australian gun legislation is under fire after a fourth shooting involving a child in as many weeks. 12-year-old Tom Ings is understood to have fallen victim to childish curiosity after an unsecured loaded rifle left him with bullet wounds to his shoulder and jaw. The incident occurred in New South Wales, which recently changed its laws around gun storage. Gun Control Australia's Samantha Lee says the changes sent a dangerous message.
In New South Wales, they recently watered down their gun laws in relation to storage. So if a police finds that a registered gun owner has a gun lying around the house, they can just issue them with a fine rather than having them turn up to court. That sends out quite a dangerous message that storage of guns is not a big concern. But what we've seen in the last few weeks is that when someone gets access to a firearm, particularly a young person, it can have lethal consequences.
Ms. Lee says tighter control over firearm storage could prevent further gun-related incidents.
What we should do to improve storage is make it legislation that an alarm system is attached to safes, and that would ensure that we'd have better security around the storage of firearms.
But State Chairman for Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party in Queensland, Clem Wheatley, says current laws are good enough.
When your firearms are not in use, they have to be locked in an approved cabinet. Now, various states have different rates of approval for what's permitted. Some of them are locked steel cabinets, some of them are locked wooden boxes. There is some talk about wanting to increase those. Increasing those are not going to make any difference. They're talking about monitored alarms. Now, what good is a monitored alarm on a property that's 60 miles from town?
In spite of recent events, Mr. Wheatley says statistics suggest licensed gun owners are not the main problem.
That's backed up by the statistical information that we have. It shows that licensed firearm owners, you know, offences by licensed firearm owners are extremely minimal.
According to the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, there are estimated to be 260,000 unlawfully held firearms across Australia. Mr. Wheatley says these unlicensed gun owners pose the greatest threat.
The greater majority of firearm crime is being committed by the people who are criminals. Now, criminals don't abide by the law. That's why they're criminals. So making more laws that only target the law-abiding is having no impact on the criminals.
Member of the Queensland Government Ministerial Advisory Panel on Firearms, Dr. Samara McFedrin, agrees that future laws should focus on unlicensed gun ownership.
Invoking changes to safe storage laws for legal owners in the context of a situation where someone who would not get a firearm license has possession of an illegal firearm. Look, it's just naive and unrealistic.
The federal government's three-month gun amnesty draws to a close on October 30. The gun amnesty allows Australians to surrender their unlicensed firearms without penalty. There is no evidence to suggest the amnesty will work to combat gun violence. Ms. Lee says unlawful gun owners see the amnesty as an opportunity to upgrade.
Look, research shows that gun amnesties, general gun amnesties, where there's been no legislative change, which is the one that's occurring at the moment, has no impact on reducing gun violence. What it does do is it gets out of the community some firearms that have been lying around for a number of years and puts them on the registration record. However, with amnesties where there is no legislative change, what's found is that people hand in their firearms that they don't use and then replace them with more modern firearms. So it's just really an upgrading rather than a decreasing of the number of firearms in the community.
Dr. McFedrin says it may prove more effective to address social and economic issues in areas where firearms cause the most problems.
When you look closely at the evidence and think about it critically, it tells us that we need to look beyond firearms and actually look at some of those other social and economic and broader societal contributors, not just to gun violence, but to violence overall. So it's a much more complex picture than people might realise.
That story was by Bianca Hrovat.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
The Spanish region of Catalonia is in the final stage of holding a referendum on its independence, with a vote set to take place on Sunday. But the Spanish government has responded to the campaign with police actions and legislation to ensure the vote doesn't go ahead. Bridget Sloan reports.
If you're a soccer fan, you might have seen signs reading, "Catalans are not Spanish," at matches recently. But chances are you've never heard of Catalonia. Either way, as founder of the Catalan National Assembly of Australia, Ramon Querol says, Catalans have a proud and independent culture.
The Catalans, we are considering like Spanish, but we have a different language, folklore, traditions and history from the Spanish state.
Catalonia is a region of Spain's northeast, centred around Barcelona. Dr. Brad Todd, a lecturer at the School of International Studies at the University of Technology Sydney, says the region is an essential part of the Spanish economy.
In some ways, we can see the case of Catalonia within Spain as comparable to the situation of Scotland within Britain, within the United Kingdom. So it's possible, obviously, for people to have both identities. People can feel both Scottish and British, and people in Catalonia can feel both Catalan and Spanish. But one of the developments in recent decades is an increase in the number of people who feel much more Catalan than they do Spanish.
The overwhelming support for the independence of Catalonia has been matched by a substantial display of power by the Spanish government.
They bring 10,000 military police to Catalonia, not for fight against the terrorists, not for the service or protect the people, just to stop a referendum and to stop the people to vote and decide the future. It's incredible because they are spending a lot of money to confiscate the ballot boxes, the ballot papers, posters.
Dr. Todd says this display of force will remind some Catalans and Spaniards of the actions of the old Franco dictatorship.
It's already clear that the actions of the Spanish government, even by people who are against independence for Catalonia, Catalans see those actions as being definitely over the top. They see it as aggressive. They see it as a reminder of the sort of things that happened under fascist regime of Francisco Franco, which only ended in 1975. It's very much within living memory.
Catalans were really oppressed. We didn't speak properly our language, respected our traditions, and we realized that after the dictatorship would be an opportunity to be friends all together in a democratic way. And we have tried for the last 38 years to be all together in a fair way, like a friends of Spain, like a community. But this has been shown that have been impossible because Spain treats us like inferior, like conquered state, and our rights haven't been respected.
The Spanish government has sent a large contingent of police officers to stop people from accessing ballots. The BBC reports Madrid has chartered 3 cruise ships to house up to 6,000 police in Barcelona and nearby city Tarragona. Ramon says that actions like these can make Catalan voters feel more like criminals than citizens.
The right to freedom of expression, assembly, association and public participation have been breached in Spain with this act to stop a referendum, not to stop terrorism or to stop criminal activities. They are treating the people that would like to vote like a criminal.
Brett Todd says the Spanish government's actions are based on laws that define the referendum as illegal.
So while on the one hand you have Catalans, including most of those who are against independence, saying that they believe they should have the right to decide, on the other side, and this is the view of most people in most of Spain, and particularly conservative Spaniards, which very much includes the current government, on that side, they remind Catalans that the Constitution does not allow for an independence referendum, because the Constitution makes it very plain that the country is indissoluble and indivisible. It talks about the unity of Spain. There's simply no mechanism for having an independence referendum. So the Spanish government is able to say that the Catalan government is acting unconstitutionally, and it actually therefore says that it's acting illegally and indeed even criminally.
Criminal or not, many Catalans are passionate about the vote and are hopeful it will ultimately secure the region's independence.
The Catalan society is really committed to vote. The international community, once we will have the legitimacy of the yes, majority of yes in the ballot boxes, they should start to make a mediation. We will sit down, the Catalan Parliament and the Spanish Parliament, to make agreement about the assets, the liabilities, and I'm pretty sure that we are going to be in the future good friends, a really good, important commercial agreement.
That story was by Bridget Sloan. A study into the political engagement of young people has discovered that while young people care about things, they're unaware of how the political process works. Dr. Zara Ghazarian, lecturer at Monash University's School of Social Sciences, spoke with Daniel Daly about his research into young people's awareness of the political process.
What this study is looking at is what young people know by the time they leave. And so we've been interviewing school leavers who are now 18 and 19 years old about how they learnt about politics and government, about civics and citizenship, and how confident they feel about participating in the political and democratic process of the country.
Why is it that you think young people are unaware of the process, even if they are interested?
What we are finding is that young people are very much interested about the issues and the political debates. We've been interviewing, so over a couple of months now, and young people have been passionate about issues such as same-sex marriage, about climate change, about the NBN. But they're far less sure when it comes to knowing how the system works, so how governments are formed, how prime ministers are elected, the role and powers of each level of government, what the House of Representatives does, what the Senate does. So they're very unsure about those sorts of institutional matters. There is a national curriculum on civics and citizenship, and every year 3 to year 10 student is included in that program, and it's all about increasing civics and citizenship knowledge. But what we're seeing over time, when the government measures what young people know, there is a real deficit in what people know about politics and government. The government's own figures from the National Assessment Program on Civics and Citizenship, the latest ones was in 2013, shows that year 10 students, about 50% of them, are not at the proficient level. And what we're seeing, of course, after that is by the time they leave high school, they are very uncertain about what and how governments function. So it is concerning, because if we have young people who are out and members of the voting population, and of course in Australia we have compulsory voting, what we have is a situation where People are turning up to vote, not really knowing how the system works, not knowing how to effectively cast a ballot.
Do you think this could have an effect, say, if there's politicians who are just outright lying about things, that voters would be less likely to be aware of whether this person's telling the truth about something because they don't know who is responsible?
The implications of our research isn't about what young people know and not know. The issue is that if we have a population that is not certain about what level of government is responsible for what service or the rules of the game, if you like, then we will have a situation where politicians can effectively dodge the bullet. They will not be held accountable because the population won't know who to hold accountable and how to hold them accountable. For there probably is a need to really somehow inject into those final years elements of Australian democracy, Australian government and Australian politics.
Mina Basali, Chief Youth Representative Officer of UN Youth Australia, agrees with some of the findings in the Monash study, but he says it's the politicians, not the issues, that are disengaging young people.
A lot of what we're finding most of the time is that young people have a really diverse set of things that they care about. They're not stereotypical young people concerns, and at the same time, they indicate their engagement with the political process is lower. What that indicates to us is that young people aren't disengaged with the issues, they're a little bit disengaged with the politicians. I think that giving them an avenue to be adequately represented and have their voices heard with, again, more nuance and more complexity than the basics of, just short sound bites about what the young people really care about, mean that they're able to lift their profile with politicians, and as representation of the issues they care about sort of comes about more, it's more and more likely that young people will feel engaged with the political process.
Despite their gaps in the knowledge, some organisations take an active role in involving young people in the political process. Catherine Castles, Governor of the Queensland Youth Parliament, says they encourage a diverse range of people to learn how governments work.
The people that apply for these positions are aged from 15 to 25, so we get a wide different age ranges, so obviously people with different experiences, and they come from completely different backgrounds. So yes, it's a application process essentially, and then we select the members to represent their electorates. We try to urge away from getting people that are just studying law or people that are just studying political sciences at university, and that's how we gauge in our application process, because we want to get a broad range of people. That's what Queensland Youth Parliament is about. We want to make sure we're getting people from diverse backgrounds with different interests and passions essentially.
Dr. Gazarian says it's crucial for young Australians to understand the political process given our compulsory voting system.
We clearly have a real need to implement the best model that we possibly can, because we are one of those rare countries that has compulsory voting. And we want to have a population that when they turn up to vote and when they are listening to election campaigns or observing politics on a day-to-day basis, they feel that they know what's going on.
Dr. Zara Gazarian from Monash University, ending that story by Danielle Daly. You are listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. You can check out anything you've heard on the show today by going to thewire.org.au. And for regular updates, just sign up to our mailing list. And on social media, we're The Wire Radio on Twitter and Facebook, The Wire, independent current affairs on community radio. Well, the UN estimates nearly half of all abortions performed around the world are unsafe. Here in Australia, safe abortions are available in medical practices around the country. But the legality of the practice is unsettled in a number of states. Tamira Francis reports.
The UN is calling for countries around the world to decriminalise abortion and allow women to access safe terminations. The World Health Organization says around 25 million abortions each year are performed unsafely, almost all in developing countries. Here in Australia, access to safe abortions is allowed in all states, whether the law is different around the country. Professor of Law at the University of Queensland, Heather Douglas, says abortion is legal in Queensland in cases where the baby's or mother's health is at risk.
The provisions in the criminal code that mean that it's illegal for a woman to have a termination, for a doctor to provide one, or for anyone to assist, and that includes providing drugs for an abortion. There is a defence under the criminal code. So in circumstances where a doctor believes that a woman's health is in serious danger, and that's her mental or physical health, then in those circumstances the doctor cut her with a termination.
Professor Douglas says laws make doctors hesitant about carrying out abortions.
It is very difficult in Queensland in particular to get access to abortion in later term pregnancies because of the state of the criminal justice legislation. And there is some evidence for that. In my own research, I've conducted interviews with doctors about these issues, and they have suggested that it's part of the reason that the criminal law is confining their activities with respect to abortion.
It's things like this that have led some to call for changes to Queensland's abortion laws. A bill to decriminalise abortion was introduced to Queensland Parliament earlier this year, but failed to pass after sustained opposition from the Liberal National Party and pro-life groups. Professor Douglas says the laws are outdated and need to be updated.
So they're already very old, and not only that, they really were in 1899 a direct copy of legislation from the UK. So they're now way over 100 years old, the provisions in the criminal code. And since then, we've had many changes, accepted that women are much more autonomous. They can work, they can earn their own incomes. It's also, there have been enormous changes in medical care in relation to terminations. We now have anaesthetics for operations that are very safe to use. We have abortifacient drugs that are freely available. We have a situation where women assume that they'll get access to an abortion if they discover that there are serious abnormalities to a fetus. Normally, women will have prenatal tests to determine if the fetus that they're carrying is healthy. So there's been a lot of changes since the introduction of this legislation.
But not everyone is convinced of the need for change. Cherish Life spokesperson Andrew Smith.
If the biggest complaint that they've got is that they are so old, or they are set so far back in time, they must surely be outdated, and therefore that's the basis of change. Really struggling to have any sort of valid argument at all. If anything, it shows that those laws have survived the test of time and there's been no need to change them. If you applied the same to, say, laws against rape and murder and said, look, they've been on the books for just as long, you know, we should change them, you'd just be laughed out. And rightly so.
Mr. Smith says the law serves a very important purpose.
Once you have the fusion of a sperm and an egg, you've got a separate organism with its own set of DNA, which just like later stages of gestation, a baby or a toddler, as long as you feed and nourish it, will grow and develop onwards. So life really does start at conception. We know that from science, and it's worth protecting. And let's face it, babies are adorable. How can you not like them?
Professor Douglas says women are the primary carers for young babies, so the law should change to give them a wider range of options.
Women's autonomy should be respected. In many cases, it's the woman going to shoulder the primary responsibility for the baby that's born, at least in the early stages. Pregnancy is in itself a dangerous activity, so women should be able to decide whether they consent to undertaking that activity. Remove the criminal offences from the criminal code, I think there would be much greater availability for women, so doctors would be much more able to provide women with much better information about what they can do in response to an unwanted pregnancy.
Professor Heather Douglas, ending that story by Tamira Francis. That's The Wire for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between Radio Adelaide, Sydney's 2SER and 4EB in Brisbane. and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us weekday, same time, on your local community radio station. If you'd like to hear us again, just visit thewire.org.au, where you'll find audio and details of any of the stories you heard here today. Jump on Twitter, just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, and on Facebook, The Wire, Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. Today's program came to you from our studios here in Brisbane at 4EB. My name is Stephen Regal. Thank you so much for your company, and we will see you next time on The Wire.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.
2SER is a grassroots, independent, non-for-profit community radio station. We've always stood for social